From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David McCullough. He's written a new biography of founding father and second U.S. president John Adams. Thomas Jefferson called him the Colossus of Independence. McCullough describes Adams as the man who did the most to drive the Declaration of Independence through the Continental Congress. Also, how to read a French fry. We talk with Russ Parsons, food editor for the Los Angeles Times, and author of a new book about the science of cooking. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Ford Motor Company has announced that it will replace 13 million Firestone tires on its vehicles. Jerome Vaughn reports for member station WDET from Dearborn, Michigan.
Ford officials made the decision to recall all 15, 16, and 17-inch Wilderness AT tires on its vehicles after completing an analysis of Firestone tires. The study, containing data from Ford, Firestone, and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, shows that Wilderness AT tires have a higher potential failure rate than comparable tires from other manufacturers. Ford officials say affected customers will be notified by mail. Vehicles with older tires will be recalled first. Ford and Lincoln dealers will replace tires free of charge. Customers who purchase their own replacements will be reimbursed. The company estimates the cost of the recall at more than $2 billion. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Vaughn in Dearborn, Michigan.
Senate Democrats are still trying to amend the $1.35 trillion tax cut bill. Republicans want the measure signed into law by Memorial Day, and they're accusing their opponents of trying to stall the measure. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says the fight is not about obstruction. He said the bill is still too heavily weighted in favor of the wealthy and doesn't do enough for middle and lower income Americans. Daschle and Republican Senator John McCain tried today to reduce the size of the cut for the wealthy, but their measure failed as four Republicans voted for it, but four Democrats voted against. Current Senate rules say a tie vote fails because the chamber is divided 50-50 on party lines. The House of Representatives has begun voting on several key education proposals, but Republicans are not happy. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
House Republicans say that in his zeal to have an education bill signed quickly, President Bush has negotiated away the only two school reform proposals worth fighting for, block grants and vouchers. So Republicans, led by Ohio's John Boehner, reintroduced vouchers today. The Bush administration, meanwhile, has worked out an agreement with Democrats that allows students in a failing public school to transfer to another public school or to receive extra tutoring at government expense. Despite opposition from conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats, the House also approved Mr. Bush's plan, which calls for testing in reading and math. The House is now expected to move quickly to reduce federal regulations in exchange for more money targeting low-income children in schools. I'm Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon offered a ceasefire today if Palestinians would do the same, but he also refused to freeze construction at existing Jewish settlements. The construction freeze is a major recommendation of the Mitchell Commission, which set out a plan for returning to peace talks yesterday. The Palestinian Authority accused Sharon of ignoring the commission, saying that the Mitchell report is the only way out of the current crisis. In stocks today, the Dow lost 81 points to close at 11,257. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 8 points. This is NPR News. Amid rumors that he's considering switching parties, Republican Senator Jim Jeffords said today that he's considering a lot of things and that he'll have an announcement tomorrow. The Vermont senator met separately today with President Bush and Vice President Cheney, apparently being lobbied to stay with the GOP. If he changes parties, Jeffords would upset the current 50-50 balance in the Senate. The Taliban, which rules most of Afghanistan, has ordered non-Muslim minorities to wear a distinctive patch on their clothing when they go outdoors. The United States condemns the order announced on Taliban-controlled radio. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the order is the latest in a long list of outrageous repressions in Afghanistan, which has become increasingly isolated because of Taliban policies.
Forcing social groups to wear distinctive clothing or identifying marks stigmatizes and isolates those groups and can never be justified.
The Taliban currently is under limited UN sanctions for allegedly supporting terrorism. The Taliban has refused to hand over Saudi fugitive Osama bin Laden. The Taliban also has been ostracized by the international community for its systematic destruction of ancient cultural relics. They include two famous 1,500-year-old Buddhas in Bamiyan. Taliban religious leaders say Islamic law does not allow representations of the human form. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Government investigators say there's no current proof that cell phones are harmful to their users, but the report says there's still not enough research to guarantee that the phones pose no risk. The General Accounting Office says it'll take years of study to determine whether the radio waves emitted by the phones pose any long-term threat. NPR, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. The nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may know my guest, David McCullough, for his work hosting the PBS series Smithsonian World and The American Experience. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Truman. A few years ago, he set out to write a book about the relationship between founding fathers Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. As he got deeper into the research, he realized that Adams' papers and his correspondences with his wife Abigail were much more forthcoming than Jefferson's writings, and that Adams was a more sympathetic figure than historians often portrayed him. So McCullough changed his project into a biography of John Adams. It's just been published. McCullough describes Adams as the person who did the most to drive the Declaration of Independence through the Continental Congress in 1776. He served as vice president under George Washington and was elected the second president of the United States. His son John Quincy was the sixth president. I asked McCullough why Adams was so determined to have the colonies win their independence from England, even though he knew that the fight for independence would be long and bloody.
He almost alone of all those of that time saw that it was going to be a long, costly, and bloody war. He thought it would last 10 years. As it turned out, it lasted 8 years, so he wasn't very far off. Many people, Jefferson among them, thought it would all be over quite quickly and that we would win rather easily. Which, of course, was worse than wishful thinking. He believed that we must have independence because he believed that independence was the only way we would have freedom. When they say free and independent, the free is dependent on the independence. We must be independent of all other foreign powers, including the mother country, if you will, Great Britain, in order to attain the kind of freedom that they envisioned, that they demanded.
What were the ways in which he felt the British were intruding on his personal freedoms and his personal life and the lives of the people he was closest to?
He felt that the British were intruding on their personal lives by and the lives of people in his community, in his own family, by taxation, by the occupation, presence in Boston of British troops, which he took to be an insult, and of course for which they were being taxed in order to cover the cost. He felt that the fundamental rights of an English citizen were being violated. It wasn't that he wanted to attain something beyond what an Englishman's rights were considered to be. He wanted to hold on, as did so many of that time, hold on to what they felt was the basic way of life, the basic freedom that his forebears had achieved, both as English subjects and by establishing a new way of life, a new country of a kind on this side of the Atlantic. Remember, he's a fourth-generation citizen of Massachusetts. Many people somehow don't remember or know that, appreciate that the country, that the settlement of this country was long before the Revolutionary War. Also, that the Revolutionary War began more than a year before the Declaration of Independence. Very important to understand. It wasn't that the Declaration of Independence then ignited a war. War had already ignited. So by the time they're at Philadelphia in 1776, a lot of blood has been spilled. And he had no misconceptions about the fact that the British intended to crush the American Revolution with force, with bloodshed, with power, and that anybody who thought otherwise was deluding themselves.
What did he tell his fellow members of the Continental Congress to convince them that it was important to have a revolution and to have a Declaration of Independence?
Well, he gave what was the greatest speech of his career, and the greatest speech given in the Continental Congress, and maybe one of the greatest and certainly one of the most important speeches ever given in American history. And we have no record of it. We really aren't sure what he said because no records were kept. Nobody was writing it down. It was all conducted behind closed doors in secrecy because of the very fear of Tories and spies in Philadelphia. But he was, in effect, saying that we must stand up for our liberties and we must join in this declaration because it's only through a declaration of independence from Britain, that is going to enable us to unite in spirit, that it will do wonders for the morale of our army, of our fighting forces. And it will guarantee, or perhaps it won't guarantee, it will certainly make it more likely that we can get support from abroad, namely from France. In other words, France, until we issued a declaration of independence, the chances of getting financial and even military support from France were going to be very, very slight. But once we broke away from England, once we declared our intention of breaking away from England, that support from France could well be forthcoming. The French weren't about to come in to help a revolution or an uprising that was on the verge of making accommodation. The French came in to support the American Revolution primarily. This is the French government, the King of France and his ministers, came into the American Revolution because it was a way of getting at England, of sticking it to England. They weren't in favor of representation, democratic representation. They didn't believe that all men were created equal, by no means. And their monarchy was, if anything, more rigid, more established, more less admirable than the monarchy of Great Britain.
On July 2nd, 1776, when the Constitutional Convention voted to accept the Declaration of Independence, John Adams wrote, "This will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore." In a way, he's describing the 4th of July celebrations that have happened ever since.
Exactly. He's the only one who said that then. Now, that doesn't mean that others didn't feel it, and maybe they did. Maybe they felt it as much or more than he did. But they didn't say so. He said so in one of the hundreds of letters that he wrote to Abigail. There are more than 1,000 letters between them, and that is the kind of outpouring that appears frequently. And it's, of course, of great importance, and it suggests what kind of fervor was felt at the time. The 4th of July, which we celebrate now, he wouldn't have understood that. That was the date on the document itself, but the actual vote took place on the 2nd, and the signing of the Declaration of Independence didn't take place until later, on August 8th, and then, even then, not everybody signed. Many people weren't there. They were still signing it on into the fall and later on. And, in fact, there's very little record of what either Adams or Jefferson even did on July 4th.
After the Declaration of Independence, Adams' town of Braintree chose him as a delegate to the state constitutional convention. Now, the national constitution had not yet been written. You describe this state constitution, the Massachusetts Constitution, as one of Adams' most admirable and longstanding achievements. And you also describe this constitution as being the longest functioning written constitution in the world. What kind of principles did he lay down in this constitution?
Well, he laid down essentially what our own national constitution stipulates, and he did so 10 years in advance of our national constitution. It did not, however, provide for freedom of religion. And years later, in his 80s, when there was a constitutional convention organized in Massachusetts to see what revisions would be necessary for the constitution of the state, Adams went and battled to make freedom of religion part of the constitution and failed to succeed. and wrote to Jefferson that he must, I must be getting old because I've lost my powers of persuasion. And he was very down about that. Jefferson applauded him for having the courage and the decency to go and fight for what was right. It has a Bill of Rights, like our Constitution. It sets up a structure, a three-part system of government, which is very similar to what we have now. The executive is the commander-in-chief. There is a legislature that's divided into a House and a Senate and so forth. And it has also in it, and I think this is so important, a clause or paragraph unlike that in any constitution written before or since, in which he says it shall be the duty, and the key word is duty, the duty of the government to provide education for everybody. And then he goes on to specify what he means by education. And what he says, in effect, is that by education, I mean everything: agriculture, finance, art, the sciences, mathematics, literature, et cetera, et cetera. And that it shall be, again, the duty of this system of education to cherish literature and the arts. And it shall be the duty of education in the Commonwealth to encourage good spirit among the people and good humor among the people. It's an amazing paragraph, which he was quite proud of and which he was quite sure would not be passed by the legislature of Massachusetts. As it turned out, it was passed. It was not only passed, it was passed unanimously and is still part of the Constitution.
Now, in the Constitution that John Adams wrote, he wrote that all men were born equally free and independent, which isn't exactly the same as saying all men are born free and equal. Why did he object to the Jeffersonian idea of all men being born free and equal?
Well, Jefferson said all men are born, all men are born equal. Adams didn't believe that. He didn't believe we're all born equal. Because he said, all you have to do is look around, and you can see that some people are born with more advantages than others. Some are stronger. Some are better looking. Some have the luck of being born into wealth advantages of all kinds. Some people are handicapped at birth. What he said and what he held to be his fundamental principle all of his life is that while all men may not be equal, they are all equal before the law and all equal in the eyes of God.
My guest is historian David McCullough. His new book is a biography of John Adams. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David McCullough, and his new book is a biography of John Adams. Adams was chosen as a minister to France during the Revolution. What was his role in negotiating the peace treaty that ended the Revolutionary War, which he helped to start?
He was one of three of our representatives at the peace treaty. Benjamin Franklin and John Jay were the two others. And they were, by European standards, neophytes as diplomats. They were untrained. No one from the United States was really trained as a diplomat, as were, say, the great diplomats of Europe. They had none of that background. They didn't see the world quite the same way. And one would assume, therefore, that they went into those negotiations and had been negotiating through the war with the handicap of being neophytes. But they did extremely well. In many ways, it was one of the most advantageous treaties that we ever signed. It was signed in Paris. It's known as the Treaty of Paris, 1783. And the most important of all achievements of the treaty was, of course, the independence of the country. The independent United States of America. And that its geographic terrain, its boundaries, reached to the Mississippi River, which was in by no means certain before the treaty was signed, and it made it doubled the size of what the colonies had been, so that it was really had become an empire, a geographic presence of great importance just with the signing of that treaty.
He read the Constitution while he was in London serving as ambassador. He was critical about some parts of the Constitution. For instance, he wanted the president to have more power. Exactly what did he want for the president, and why did he want it?
Well, he believed in a strong executive, and he believed that the Constitution did not provide a strong enough executive office. He felt that that was the only way you were going to hold together these very different and disparate colonies, 13 colonies. Jefferson, by contrast, wanted a weaker presidency and more power in the legislature, and in this they differed. Adams also wanted a Bill of Rights. There was no, initially, as you know, no Bill of Rights. Jefferson, though he later said there should be a Bill of Rights, when he first read the Constitution, did not object to the fact that there was no Bill of Rights. Adams strongly endorsed the new Constitution and said so by letter home. Jefferson was equivocal about the new Constitution. So I think those are the principal differences.
Adams said of Jefferson about the difference between the two of them, "You are afraid of the one, I of the few. We agree perfectly that the many should have full, fair, and perfect representation. You are apprehensive of monarchy, I of aristocracy. I would therefore have given more power to the presidency and less to the Senate." Can you describe that split a little bit more, why Adams felt that whereas Jefferson was afraid of monarchy, Adams was afraid of aristocracy?
Well, Jefferson was fearful that the presidency would become fixed, that it could lead to monarchy, that it could lead to a king. And, of course, the king was the only way that people had ever lived under. That was what everyone was accustomed to. And that the country might resort to that if things got difficult or contentious. Adams was more concerned about what he called the aristocracy, which he saw as being the Senate. And he was worried that there were certain people who would naturally gain control because they had more education, they had more money, they had more connections, influence, whatever one wishes to call it, and that the best way to control them was to contain them in the Senate. And when he talks about trusting the many, he's talking about the representation, the direct representation in the House. So he wanted a weaker Senate and a stronger executive. Jefferson was more inclined to the reverse.
Jefferson and Adams were partners in creating a revolution in America, and in writing the Declaration of Independence, or at least in conceiving the Declaration of Independence. Adams became the second president. Jefferson was his vice president. Then they ran against each other, and Jefferson won in that election. How did they end up becoming enemies after being such close partners?
Well, primarily because Jefferson made no effort to be of any help to Adams when Jefferson was serving as Adams' vice president. And because Jefferson was an ardent Republican, as they said then, the Republican Party of that time later became the Democratic Party of our time, and was very much involved with the politics of the Republican Party behind the scenes. And as it turned out, later on it was discovered that Jefferson had been paying the man who was attacking Adams most viciously in the press, the famous scandalmonger James Callender. And when that became known, it was crushing for Adams personally, that his friend had betrayed him. And Abigail really never forgave Jefferson for that. It's, I think, much to Adams' credit that Adams was willing to forgive. I'm not sure he ever forgot, but he certainly did forgive. And they had a reconciliation after they had each retired from the presidency, brought about through their mutual friend Benjamin Rush. And that's when the great correspondence between Jefferson and Adams commenced in 1812 and lasted until the end of their lives in 1825.
John Quincy Adams was the first son of a president to become a president. George W. Bush is the second. In the remaining minute that we have, any comparisons you could make?
Well, there are some comparisons. The father, in both cases, the father is very extremely fond of the son fond of the father. Both John Quincy and President Bush had strong mothers, to say the least. John Quincy and President Bush, had the benefit of a privileged education. Beyond that, the similarities begin to become less conspicuous. To say that George Bush Sr. and George W. Bush are not the equals of John Adams and John Quincy Adams is not quite fair. I'm not sure anybody today is the equal of John Adams and John Quincy Adams. They were two of the most brilliant human beings who ever became president. I think if you gave all the presidents of the United States an IQ test, that John Quincy Adams might come in first. He wasn't a particularly strong or effective president, but he was brilliant and maybe the best Secretary of State we ever had, a man of great humanity beneath what seemed to many a rather austere manner.
Any final thought you'd like to leave us with about John Adams?
Yes, I think that no one can really understand John Adams and the kind of human being he was without understanding his marriage and Abigail. She is the key, not just to much of what life in that time was like, but what kind of idealism he followed. They were people of principle. I think one example of that is that John Adams was the only founding father who never owned a slave on principle. And Abigail was in full agreement with him on it.
Well, David McCullough, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
David McCullough is the author of a new biography of John Adams. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Cats and Men, a story collection by Nina de Grammont. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why a whole onion smells different from a chopped one, and why fresh cooking oil can make disappointing fried food. We get a couple of lessons in the science of cooking from Russ Parsons, food editor of the Los Angeles Times and author of the new book, How to Read a French Fry. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eating out a lot has taught many Americans to be knowledgeable about ordering subtle and complex dishes from around the world. But it has left many of us less knowledgeable about how to cook our own food. That's one reason Russ Parsons has devoted his new book to the science of cooking. The more you know about why meat browns, why sauces emulsify, and how frying is different from roasting, the more likely you are to be able to follow a recipe or improvise in the kitchen. Parsons' new book is called How to Read a French Fry and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science. He's also food editor of the Los Angeles Times. He started getting interested in kitchen science a few years ago when his editor assigned him to write a piece about onions.
Onions? What do you write about onions? So I decided I'd do a piece about all of the kind of folklore about how onions make you cry. And so I rounded up the usual suspects and talked to chefs and things. And what I realized was that nobody that I talked to really knew why onions made you cry. And so I thought, well, I'll just kind of dabble into this food science thing and see if I can find somebody who can address that question. And it opened up this incredible array of knowledge that I didn't even know was out there. And the people were so anxious to talk. You know, the first guy I talked to, he's a guy who'd been studying onion chemistry for like 20 years. And what he told me was really interesting. You know, when you have an onion of whatever kind, and you smell it before it's been cut, it smells different than an onion that's been cut.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, essentially an onion, and essentially most foods, are big bags of water. In the water, in the onion, there are these little vacuoles. They're little pockets of different chemicals. When you cut an onion, all those vacuoles are disrupted. The chemicals empty out, and they begin to combine with each other. You get these chemical reactions. And then those chemicals combine, the resultant chemicals combine again. And this guy, I'll never forget when he said this, because it was kind of like the key that unlocked this whole thing. He said it was a cascade of chemical reactions that occurred in the blink of an eye. And I was just fascinated by that. And so then I started pursuing the whole onion thing further. And
let me stop you. Those chemicals are what makes us tear?
Eventually. You know, the raw chemicals don't, but after the fifth or sixth generation of combining and recombining, the result is a kind of a sulfur gas. And actually, it's not clear at this point whether the sulfuric gas goes up your nose or goes directly to the eye. But either way, it irritates you, and it makes your eyes tear as a result of that. And the great thing is that the chemical name for those chemicals are lacrimators, from the Latin word for tear, lacrima.
Well, let's get to the taste. How does the taste of an onion change when it's cut and when it's cooked?
Now, what happens is that you've got the sweet onions that you pay, you know, $4 or $5 a pound for. Those onions aren't really any higher in sugar than the brown storage onions that you buy in a big bag for, you know, 95 cents for 5 pounds. The difference between the two is that the sweet onions are actually lower in the chemicals that produce the tearing effect. Now, the interesting thing is that those chemicals are heat volatile, which means that as soon as they are heated, they evaporate. They go off into the air, which is also why you might start tearing when you're frying onions. So when you cook a brown onion, when you cook one of those regular old cheap storage onions, the chemical compounds go away. Those sulfuric compounds, the ones that make you cry, the ones that make the onions taste hot and unpleasant when they're raw, they go away. And what's left is an onion that's sweeter than the so-called sweet onions. What's also left behind is more onion flavor. If you've ever tried to do, I think there were when those sweet onions first came out, the first thing everybody wanted to do with them, of course, was make onion soup. Well, the result almost universally was an onion soup that didn't really taste like very much, because part of that really delicious oniony flavor is that little bit of the acidity that's left behind, that little bit of those chemicals. So you're much better if you're going to eat an onion raw, like on a sandwich or something like that. Well, those sweet onions are wonderful, but if you're going to cook them, you're absolutely wasting your money. Somebody described it. I was talking to a scientist in A lot of those onions, the first of the really popular sweet onions came from Vidalia, Georgia. And I was talking to one of the guys who was raising them, and he was a real good old boy. And he said that cooking a Vidalia onion was like mud bogging in a Rolls Royce.
Do you have a favorite onion soup recipe?
Probably the classic, you know, that kind of French onion soup that where you cook the onions very long, you shred them fairly thick, actually. I cook them that way. And you cook them real low, real slow, so that they brown, they come to a very deep brown. And then you add some cognac and you add some beef stock, cook it for a little bit longer, and then you put it in the big soup plate and cover it with a crouton with some good cheese on it.
How long does that take to make?
That's delicious. Oh, an hour maybe.
That's not bad.
That's not bad. Cooking's not bad. Don't be scared.
My guest is Russ Parsons, and he's the food editor of the LA Times and author of the new book, How to Read a French Fry, and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science. Let's talk about the principles of frying. Now, we think of frying as being like a really hot form of cooking, but compare oven heat to frying heat and how it affects the foods that are being cooked.
Well, that's one of those really great paradoxes. Why can you stick your hand in a 500-degree oven, but you can't stick your hand in 200-degree water or in 200-degree oil? It's because the way we measure heat is very imperfect. Temperature is what we usually refer to when we're talking about heat. But temperature is a measure of how fast these molecules are moving. You know, heat is motion, kind of. What temperature doesn't measure is how quickly the heat is being transmitted. Now, in an oven, for example, you're cooking in air, and an air is not very dense. You know, there are very few molecules per square inch. It takes a while for that heat to transmit itself to whatever is being put in there. It's not, you know, it's not bumping up against things very often. With water, it's more dense, and so the water transmits the heat much more quickly. Now, water has this interesting thing too, though, that it's not as dense as oil, so that when water gets to a certain point, those molecules begin to break loose and they go up in the air. You know, they're steam. That point is 212 degrees. With oil, the magic of oil is that it's denser than water, and so the molecules stick together better. And so you can get oil up to 400 degrees where you can't get water any higher than 212. That's important in cooking because the kinds of browning reactions, the things that make food brown, they don't really start happening until you get to about, between 300 and 350 degrees. So there's lesson one right there. No matter if you cook something when there's any moisture present, no matter how long you cook it, it's never going to turn brown.
Why does frying crisp the outside of whatever you're cooking?
The special thing about frying is that in most kinds of cooking, whether you're talking about roasting in an oven or boiling in water, the cooking medium doesn't change very much. The water stays essentially the same. The air stays essentially the same. I mean, there are fine differences, but essentially they're the same. With frying, both the oil that this food is being fried in and the food are changing all of the time. For example, one of the common problems people have with when they're deep frying things is that the first batch never turns out. Well, there's a good reason why it never turns out. With really fresh oil, again, most of the foods that we cook are made up primarily of water. Oil and water don't mix. So when you put a piece of food in really hot oil, all of the moisture comes to the surface, and it forms this a moisture barrier that the oil can't penetrate. So the oil can't really touch the food that's being fried. Now, as the frying progresses, as the oil is heated and more things are added to it, the oil begins to break down. One of the byproducts of this breakdown is soaps, or chemical soaps. These aren't the same kinds of things that you wash your hands with, but they're very close. And, you know, when you wash your hands, what soap does is it allows the water to penetrate the grease that's on your hand. The soaps in frying do exactly the same thing. They allow the cooking oil to penetrate that water barrier so that the cooking oil comes in direct contact with the food that's being fried so that it browns it better and it cooks it through more thoroughly.
So the more you use oil, the more efficient it's going to be.
Up to a point. And then the oil begins to break down to a point where it's you get these kinds of the chemicals come off of it. You get these nasty kinds of odors, and it's no longer working as well as it could. That's kind of where the title "How to Read a French Fry" came from. When I was talking to one of the scientists who was studying oil chemistry, and he started explaining all of this stuff to me, and I said, "No, give me an example. Give me an example." I said, "Well, look at a French fry. You know, the next time you go to a fast food place, look at a French fry, and you can see at what stage the oil was. I mean, there's usually four stages of oil. There's, you know, pure oil. Then there's oil beginning to break down. Then there's oil that's at the perfect frying stage. And then there's what they call runaway oil, when it's broken down to the point where it no longer functions. A French fry fried in really pure oil, really fresh oil, it won't be as brown. It probably won't be cooked all the way through. There will probably be a little bit of a raw part at the center of the French fry. When it begins to break down, that kind of first stage when it's really good for frying, the French fry will be browner, and you'll start to see it'll be cooked all the way through. When it's really perfect, when the oil is perfect for frying, the French fry will be really well browned. The corners will be really crisp. It'll be cooked all the way through, so that you have that kind of that perfect French fry combination of really crisp exterior and almost a steamy inside. And you'll have all of these delicious flavors from the oil, because good oil is essentially delicious, which is why we fry so many foods in it. Then when it gets into the runaway stage, what will happen is you'll see that it'll be brown very quickly. There'll be really dark spots on it, kind of black, where it started to burn a little bit. And the French fry will have started to collapse in on itself. It won't be attractive anymore. And you'll also get the flavor. There is an old oil flavor that's not very attractive.
Everything you're saying sounds very familiar. I don't mean the information. I mean the descriptions of the French fries.
Well, see, that's one of the really fascinating things about this, is that this is all stuff that when you cook, you recognize it down the road. What this does is kind of explain to you why it's happening, and in a way, kind of summing up 20 years of making cooking mistakes and explaining, oh, here's what went wrong, so that it's a little bit like it's kind of a cooking course.
My guest is Russ Parsons, author of the new book How to Read a French Fry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Russ Parsons, is food editor of the LA Times and author of a new book about kitchen science called How to Read a French Fry. Now, you've learned a lot of things about the science of fruits and vegetables, both raw and cooked. Tell us a couple of principles we could keep in mind when we're buying fresh fruits and vegetables.
Well, there's kind of two stages of things to think about. One of them is selecting. You know, when you go to the store, how do you pick something that's good? The second part is, how do you store it once you get it home? The first part, the really simple answer is, this is almost embarrassing, the really simple answer is that the stuff that the fruit or the vegetable that's heaviest for the size is going to be the best, almost invariably.
Is that because it's holding more water?
It's got more water. One of the things that happens after fruits or vegetables have been picked, they continue to respirate. And they continue to give off moisture. If you stick a piece of zucchini in the refrigerator and it stays there for, I don't want to go into details because it's embarrassing, but what you find when you pull it out is it's shriveled.
That's right.
Because it's given up all of the moisture. Now that's a continuous process that begins at the time that it's picked. So if you pick the fruit or the vegetable that's heaviest or that looks the most like it has the most water in it. You know, there's that kind of, like with eggplant, there's that beautiful, it almost looks like it's bursting. You're going to be a lot better off. The second thing is, when you get it home, know what to refrigerate and what not to refrigerate. With vegetables, almost all of them should be refrigerated. With fruits, and in this case, I'm including especially tomatoes, which most people don't think of as fruits, but they are a fruit, and it's important to remember it in this case. Be very careful about what you refrigerate. We're coming up into the time of year now when you're going to get lots of peaches and nectarines. And most of the peaches and nectarines that you buy in the store aren't going to be very good. What that means is that they're picked before they're very ripe. If you really want that kind of, that really juicy peach, there is a trick that you can do. It'll never be as good as a great tree-ripened peach, but if you store it at room temperature, preferably in a paper bag, for a day or 2 days, and you will see that the texture has changed. And as the texture changes, what's happening is the cells in the peach are beginning to break down a little bit. That's what ripening is. It sounds unpleasant, but it actually tastes very good. And as those cells break down, again, we get that combination and recombination of different chemical compounds. So the flavor is more complex. It won't be sweeter because once something is picked from the plant, it doesn't accumulate more sugar, but it can taste sweeter and will definitely taste better and the texture will be better.
What does the paper bag do to help ripen the fruit?
It's this weird thing, and nobody can understand. I haven't read a satisfactory explanation yet why it happens, but when fruit is on a tree, when the fruits begin to ripen, they give off an ethylene gas that is a signal to the other fruits on the tree that it's time to begin ripening. When you store these fruits in a paper bag, what it does is it traps the gas so that they all get the message a lot quicker, I guess is one way to look at it.
Let's get to meat and fish. You talk a little bit about the differences in some meats and that how that has to do with the muscles of the meat and whether the muscles are actually used or not in that
right.
part of the body. And I guess a really good example is the white meat and the dark meat of chicken. Would you talk about that?
People tend to sometimes think meat is meat, but meat isn't. You know, I mean, there's a big difference between poultry and what I call poultry and meat. Then within meat, there's a big difference between pork and lamb and beef. There's also within each animal, there's a big difference from one part of the animal to the other, and it has to do with how much work that part gets. Really tender parts, like the breast of a chicken, those are parts that don't get very much work. You know, chickens will fly if they're provoked, but they don't fly very often, and they don't fly very far. But they do walk around a lot, and so the leg muscles tend to be much more developed than the breast muscles do. What happens when the muscles are more developed, not only the reason that the meat is darker is because there's more blood circulating to it because of the exercise, but also there's more connective tissue. And connective tissue, when it's cooked all the way through, if it's not cooked, it can be stringy. But when it's cooked all the way through, it actually acts as a lubricant that makes the food juicier. That's why, for example, when you're making a beef stew, you'd never want to make a beef stew with a really expensive cut of meat, you know, with a fillet or something like that. There's no connective tissue there at all. It'll just come, you know, the meat will fall apart. You want to cook it with a piece that's really, with a meat that's really been worked. A chuck steak, which comes from lower down on the body, or, you know, for example, lamb shanks or something like that, where it's a piece that's really been worked a lot, has a lot of connective tissue. You cook it really long, you cook it really slow, and when the meat gets up to about 160 degrees, what happens is that all of that connective tissue begins to melt right into the meat, and it keeps it moister.
Now, how has what you've learned about meat and muscles affected the way you cook meat?
One of my problems that I used to have a lot especially with braising, was that I would add too much liquid. And understanding how the braising process works, again, we're talking about cooking with moisture added to it. What the moisture does in this case is it, instead of breaking down the cellulose, obviously beef doesn't have cellulose, it helps break down the connective tissue. But you just need enough to make the container really, really humid inside when it's heated. So you don't need it, it's not a soup, and it's not going to reduce very much. So kind of figuring out how that worked. It's also important for when you're making stews and braises and things like that, to know that if you don't brown the meat beforehand, it's not going to brown at all. And that's because you're cooking it with moisture present. As long as there's moisture present, that temperature is never going to get, even if it's in a 350-degree oven, if it's cooked in a, you know, you're cooking it in a Dutch oven or something like that, the way you do for a braise, a covered pan, the temperature inside that pan is never going to get above 212 degrees because of the moisture until all of that is evaporated. So it's never going to brown. You need to brown it beforehand if you want those kind of really delicious brown flavors.
My guest is Russ Parsons, author of the new book, How to Read a French Fry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Russ Parsons, food editor of the L.A. Times and author of a new book about kitchen science called How to Read a French Fry. Now how does all this information about muscle and connective tissue apply to fish, if at all?
Well, fish is kind of weird because fish has very little connective tissue for the simple reason that fish live in basically a gravity-free environment. You know, think of a cow and how much muscle it takes for a cow to be able to fight gravity enough to stand up or move around. You know, fish just kind of float there. They float very free. And so there isn't very much connective tissue. What that means is that fish cook very, very quickly because because there isn't very much connective tissue. The muscles are also arranged differently. I mean, when you look at a piece of fish that's been cooked, you see how it flakes off in those segments. That's the way the muscles are arranged in a fish rather than the long, bunchy muscles that animals have. So with fish, the thing to remember is don't overcook it. It doesn't need the same amount of cooking that meat does because it doesn't have the same obstacles to overcome that meat has.
And what's the problem if you overcook it?
If you overcook it, what's going to happen? When you overcook anything, what happens is the proteins in the meat, when they're heated, they begin to connect, and they connect harder and harder and harder. Eventually, they squeeze out any of the moisture. So any kind of meat, whether it's fish or poultry or lamb or beef, if you cook it long enough, you're going to end up with the same dry, crumbly, flavorless a product. It just happens faster with fish than it does with the others.
Would you share an easy-to-make, easy-to-describe fish recipe?
Yeah, here's a great one. I learned this from Paula Wolford, actually, who's a great friend and a great cookbook writer who lives in Sonoma. It's really good at this time of year, too, because it uses salmon, has become kind of the poultry of the fish world because it's farmed so much. It's always in the stores. It's always a fairly reliable product. But at this time of year, the salmon begin their spawning runs, and so this is when the wild salmon season starts. Wild salmon is it's lower in fat, but it's got a much it's got a denser texture, and I think it's got more flavor than regular salmon. So what you do is take a salmon fillet, skin it. You can have the fishmonger do that. Put it on a cookie sheet. Stick it in a 300-degree oven over a pan of like a baking pan full of boiling water. What you're actually doing is kind of converting the oven to a really low-temperature steamer. And what's going to what you'll find is that it'll take 20 or 30 minutes to be done. You can look at it. The doneness point on this is very long. It'll take it a long time to overcook because it's in a very moist environment. But what you'll find is that the salmon retains that kind of beautiful orange color even though it's cooked all the way through. What you end up with is a salmon with a great kind of voluptuous texture and a really deep flavor. And it can be served either, you can do this either hot or serve it at room temperature. You can do it just as you would a steamed salmon, except that the flavor's better and the texture's better.
Well, Russ Parsons, thank you so much for talking with us.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Russ Parsons is food editor of the LA Times and author of the new book, How to Read a French Fry. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. I want to remind you that on Friday, we'll pay tribute to Susanna McCorkle, a great jazz singer who died over the weekend. We'll close today's show with her recording of Taking a Chance on Love.
Here I go again, hearing trumpets blow again, all aglow again, taking a chance. Here I slide again, about to take that ride again, starry-eyed again, taking a chance. This game I'm taking a crack at needs good luck for me. So now I'm taking a whack at any black cat that I see. Here I'm booked again, in the swim and hooked again. This goose of mine is cooked again, taking a chance.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Wesley Clark, NATO's commander during the war with Yugoslavia, NATO's first and only war. He's written a new memoir called Waging Modern War. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.